as always, this segment of Talking Ball brought to you by the fine folks of Terrell Technical Services Incorporated, the largest environmental health, industrial hygiene, indoor air quality service provider in North Alabama. They are now conducting pre- and post-surface disinfection verification assessments for the COVID-19 virus. TTSI supports school systems, universities, colleges, government facilities, healthcare, elder care, retail, commercial, manufacturing, and industrial facilities. If they can help you by documenting proper disinfection with reoccupancy clearance testing for the COVID-19 virus, give them a call, 256-461-9278. We roll along on a Thursday morning, and we know a lot of people watched The Last Dance. It set record numbers on ESPN, and I guess you could say now that the weeks after, Michael Jordan is getting a lot of backlash from the video, a lot of people nitpicking the video, so to speak. But still, I tell you what, it was one of the most entertaining 10-part series that I've ever sat through to watch.
It was, and we're honored now to be joined by a very special guest on the Neighbors Wealth Management Hotline here on this Thursday morning. From 1988 to 2001, he was an NBA player who was on the first three Bulls championship teams from 91 to 93. He also was an NBA champion in 99 in the strike-shortened season the year after The Last Dance for the San Antonio Spurs. He was SEC Player of the Year in 1988 for CM Newton at Vanderbilt University. And, of course, we're talking about a first-round draft choice picked 11th overall in the NBA draft. And that was Will Perdue, and he's been good enough to join us this morning. Will, welcome to Huntsville. You're with Drew and Scott. It's an honor to speak with you. How are you this morning?
Well, gentlemen, I'm doing well. So glad we were able to finally work something out. And, the interesting thing is we're, 10 days out now, and I'm still amazed by the amount of traction that The Last Dance is getting. And, I appreciate that you guys used the word nitpicking. I just wish that people could have taken – what they saw, and let me say, overall, I thought they did a really, really good job of talking about, what it's like to play at that level, but also talking about, what it's like to play with, I guess you could say, for Michael Jordan, because it wasn't necessarily easy. It was enjoyable. It was demanding. But as you pointed out, I think for some reason, people want to continue to, nitpick, take it apart, point out the negatives. At the end of the day, I just said, that's who Michael Jordan was. If anybody really wanted to know, and if you didn't grasp it, go back and watch that series again, and then I think you'll figure it out.
Yeah, you mentioned what it was like to play for Michael Jordan. When you arrived there and Michael was Michael, what was that like to try to blend in, try to fit in, ultimately try to be a part of that organization? Because, he wanted to make everybody better is what I got from the documentary. But like you said, it wasn't always easy.
No, it wasn't. And listen, some people ask me now, how did you deal with that? How that must have been difficult. And remember, he was already there when I showed up in Chicago. So he was already cultivating that culture. He was already that way. I just thought that's what the NBA was. It's the big boy league. This is what you have to do. So I, always pride myself on my work ethic and how I came at Vanderbilt. But I also realized because I was playing with Michael Jordan that, hey, you've got to do a better job, man. Your work ethic has to get better. You've got to do whatever it takes to get better. But one of the many things I try to point out to guys, the people that, weren't fortunate enough like I was to play at that level. You also got to remember the times were different then. It was more about respect, earning the respect of your teammates, earning the respect of your opponent, more so than developing a relationship or a friendship. You were more concerned about develop that respect first. If a friendship or relationship comes from that, that's great. But we're all here for one purpose, and that was taught to us by Michael. We have the pieces. We should be winning a championship, and if we don't, it's a huge disappointment. So what do we need to do in order to continue to get better?
And we're talking to Will Perdue, who, as we said, he's still part of the Chicago Bulls organization. He does. He's an analyst for NBC Sports Chicago for the Bulls pre- and post-game. I know he still casts such a wide net. What kind of impact does he still have on the organization today? Yeah, I know they. It's been 22 years. They have not been able to recapture the magic. But how big a shadow does he still cast?
Well, there's a lot of people that think that that's one of the reasons why they can't get, you know, big name free agents to go there, because nobody wants to be in the shadow of Michael Jordan. You know, they got the big statue out in the you know, the atrium area when you first enter the United Center of, you know, Michael. That's a big shadow to play under. But, you know, Derrick Rose did it, but unfortunately he got hurt, so that was, you know, as far as you talk about capturing the magic, that was short-lived. You know, it's people that believe that, you know, there's some bad blood between Michael and the organization. Don't know. You know, there's still a lot of what-ifs, could-be's regarding that, but, you know, it's just one of those things. It just, if you want to truly understand the impact that somebody had, not only on the league, just on culture, about how popular he is, and when was the last time he played, we didn't even have social media back then.
Yeah, exactly.
The one thing that I was in awe of every time I saw it was when you guys would go on the road to play. The amount of people, and when we see this a lot because we're an SEC football country, and when Alabama travels or Auburn travels, it's that way outside. Not that way, but people follow them to an extent. But the amount of fans that would show up at the hotels on the road was just mind-blowing to me.
Oh, it's still, when I think about it to this day, I mean, you know, being in the Eastern Conference, obviously we – went with some cold cities, Milwaukee, Detroit, Cleveland, you know, in and out of Chicago. But I tell the stories all the time about, you know, you played back-to-backs or you would leave after a game when we started flying charter. You would get somewhere at 2:30 in the morning and you'd pull in the hotel at 2:45 and it's, you know, with the wind chill, it's 3 below 0, but yet there's 250 people outside the hotel thinking, hoping, praying that possibly they may get Michael Jordan's autograph friends with him. And I'm just like, these people are idiots. I mean, it's just, it's not going to happen, but that's just, they wanted to put themselves in the position to at least give themselves an opportunity if by chance he decided he wanted to stop and sign. And it's just, I never could understand that. And I talk about between the first three-peat, as I always talk about, hey, we were kind of like the Rolling Stones. But the second three-peat, because of how much better Scotty had gotten and now they had Dennis, I said it was almost like a combination of the Rolling Stones and the Beatles all at once.
No question about it. There was some real star power there. And, Will, you to circle back to what you talked about earning respect, I heard a conversation that you had on a national show that really it piqued my interest, because you talked about how even back in those days when you were playing at Vanderbilt and rose to prominence in the SEC, you know, ESPN was a factor, but it's not the factor it is now. And a lot of guys, even in the NBA, didn't see everybody play around the country. And so you really had to prove yourself to a guy like Michael Jordan, who probably was still seeing a lot of Big Ten and ACC basketball, of course, with North Carolina, but didn't see a lot of the Southeastern Conference and didn't see you play.
No, he didn't. You know, he never truly admitted that, but you know, I had learned through the media, he had made a comment that, you know, he didn't really know much about me. So when I was drafted, he goes, well, I'm going to start calling him Will Vanderbilt, because obviously he wasn't good enough to go to a Big Ten school. So, you know, I kind of thought that, you know, a little bit of a backhand compliment. But, you know, it's one of those things. I just realized that his expectations are higher than anybody can imagine, probably more so than even – you know, players at that level with the pride that we have and the egos that we have, his was probably even higher than that, because he felt like he obviously had the skill set. Same time, he realized, like it or not, you're going to help me win a championship, and this is how you're going to do it. Now, it took a while, and that championship in 91 was 3 years coming as far as being able to get past the Detroit Pistons. But it was just a combination of personnel, a combination of the offense, the triangle, and a combination of, you know, Michael getting better, but also Michael developing that trust in his teammates to help him win championships.
Yeah, I got to ask you that. You brought up the Detroit Pistons, and obviously I grew up in that era of watching the NBA basketball. What was that physicality like to go through that series before you guys were able to get over the hump, and then that series of finally getting able to get over the hump of the Detroit Pistons?
Quite honestly, it was more about being able to contain your emotions. Listen, Chuck Daly, who was the head coach of the Pistons back then, even talked about it. You know, listen, we know it's not necessarily an aesthetically pleasing brand of basketball, but that's the way we have to play in order to play at our best and in order to win. And not just win games, but to win a championship. And they won back-to-back championships, you know, in 89 and 90. So it was the style of basketball that they had developed. And it's a copycat league, so we had to play. We had to figure out how to play that way, but the thing that took us a while to realize was, is try to take your emotions out of it. If you're trying to play physical because they have to, realize that this had a lot to do with Phil Jackson and the maturation of the team, but also, you know, Phil as the head coach, you know, continually preaching this to us about we still have to play a physical style of basketball, but we also have to play our style of basketball, meaning don't react to what they do. Be smarter when you react to what they do. You know, if they foul Michael real hard on a play, don't react to the hard foul because we're getting ready to get two free throws. Don't get a technical because then it's a wash. We don't have the advantage anymore. You get back at them when Isaiah or Dumars comes down the lane. And, yes, it was physical. Yes, it was bordering on the brink of, you know, dirty basketball. I think overall it wasn't necessarily dirty. At times it got dirty. But for the most part, it was just the physicality style of them trying to intimidate their opponent. And you had to adapt and learn how to play that way, but also control your emotions so you don't allow them to push you over the top.
And, Will, I wanted to ask you, too. He's considered one of the top maybe 50 guys of all time. He's a great player, but I've always thought, too, that he was the perfect complement to Michael Jordan with the way he developed. In some ways, the Last Dance wasn't as flattering for Scottie Pippen, but I still am not sure that he gets the full credit he deserves because he was criminally underpaid for his time in Chicago. And, of course, that was his decision because he was trying to help his family at the time. He wanted the financial security. But talk about how good really Scottie was.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, people always ask me about, well, how can you say it's, you know, the Last Dance was – fairly accurate. Well, I think it gave you a really good feeling of what it was like to play on those teams, to play with Michael, the atmosphere, the culture, as you asked earlier about, you know, dealing with the fans. But, you know, they also, you know, talked about Scottie not willing to go in with 1.8 seconds to go against the Knicks when, you know, the year Michael wasn't there, or, you know, signing that contract because he needed the security for his family. He needed that guarantee, what Jerry Reinsdorf told him, that, hey, you're going to outplay this contract. Don't sign it. But yet at the end of the day, it's a business. And then how in 98, you know, he delayed his surgery because he didn't want to have to play the full season and he wanted to send a message. That's just all part of the game. I wish it would have focused, you know, a little bit more about, you know, how good Scottie really was. I always talk about people, you know, let's talk about the 98 championship, which this thing was developed, you know, around the Last Dance. You go back and just look at the numbers. He was the second leading scorer behind Michael. A pretty big gap. He only averaged, I think, 17 points a game, but it wasn't about that. It was he guarded the opponent's best player every single night, and he thrived in that role. He was second on the team in rebounds behind Dennis, and not by a lot, just by a few. He was first on the team in assists, first on the team in steals. First on the team in minutes played, and that's just during the 98 playoffs. That's just a glimpse of how good he was, how important he was. I know early on in that Last Dance documentary, Michael mentioned, you know, hey, without Scottie Pippen, Michael Jordan doesn't win six championships, but I still don't think that gave him the credit. I mean, I think players knew how good he was because he was voted top 50 of all time. But unfortunately, you know, in his prime, he always played in Michael's shadow. And by the time he got to Houston, you know, Charles was there, Hakeem Olajuwon was there, but he still wasn't the same player because of the injuries, because of the surgeries. But he was still really good. It's just, you think about how the guys that he had to guard and the guys that he shut down, and it all started in that championship we won in 91 when Scottie started to guard Magic. That totally, yeah, right. We lost the first series, but we won the next four, most notably because of what Scottie did defensively on Magic.
Yeah, and Will, I got to say, I don't think Scottie gets enough credit. I think everybody really saw how good he was when Michael played baseball for a couple years and the Bulls stayed. They weren't a championship team. They were still a very, very good team because of Scottie and the way he led the team and, of course, became that number one option for a short period of time.
Yeah, I mean, we won 55 games that year. That a lot had to do with him. I mean, it was still a feeling out period for him, but then that also showed how good he was, but then also showed, when run properly, how good the triangle offense was and how effective it could be.
I got to ask you, too, and speaking of the triangle, that's a great segue into to Phil Jackson. First, obviously, zen is the word that comes to mind when you think of Phil Jackson and the triangle. So, first of all, his calming influence and his zen approach, and then how difficult really was that triangle, because they tried to explain it on The Last Dance, and it got confusing.
But Phil took a different approach. You know, one of the things is they talked about when Phil was growing up was, you know, his father was a minister, his mother was a preacher. So, you know, that was the culture he grew up in. So he was a little different. But as you talked about, you know, Native American philosophy, the Zen philosophy, the different approaches that he believed in. You know, when I was there in the first three-peat, you know, we used to do breathing exercises. You know, we kind of thought he was out in left field, but he used to just do things differently. You just kind of had to accept that. But it was effective. He knew how to get the guys. He knew how to push guys' buttons. But to be clear on the triangle, the triple post, that was Tex Winter's offense. Tex Winter did that when he was at Northwestern, K-State, when he was in Long Beach State. That was something that he developed. But it was, you know, the trust that Phil had in Tex, but also in the offense. Jerry Krause was the one that went out and got Phil, who went out and got Tex to put those guys together. And it was an offense that was a read offense. There weren't really a lot of plays. So a lot of times, you know, you run an offense trying to make the defense do something. That offense was dictated on what the defense did. So regardless of what the defense did, there was always a counter. And when it was run properly, you just couldn't stop it. Now, that didn't happen often. Michael was a good bailout guy when he was with the Bulls. You know, Kobe was a good bailout guy when they ran it with the Lakers. But that was the thing. I mean, it's hard to say. Everybody wanted to talk about, well, you always had Michael. But that year we won 55 games with no Michael. Scottie was not a guy like Michael who could go about creating his own shot. He was really good. But that was the offense. That was the effectiveness of the offense. And that showed just how difficult it was to stop that offense.
And, Will, final few minutes with Will Perdue, as we said, pre- and post-game for NBC Sports Chicago with the Chicago Bulls, former Bulls player and, of course, world champion with them three times and with the Spurs and, of course, SEC Player of the Year at Vanderbilt. Jerry Krause was kind of vilified in this documentary, and I was very critical of him. What was your thoughts? You just gave him a lot of credit. He put the coaching staff together. He did build these teams. What were your thoughts on Jerry Krause?
But I felt, unfortunately, in the documentary, he was vilified, you know, for that. Now, did it do a good job of depicting who Jerry Krause was? Yeah. He wasn't a very, you know, he wasn't a people person. Those that didn't know him didn't think he had a soft side. He was very protective of his family. But he also considered the Chicago Bulls to be his family. He hated the media. He thought the media was the devil. He didn't handle the media very well. But anybody thinks that it was him and him only that dismantled the Bulls. He didn't even dismantle the Bulls. They tried to. I think a lot of people like to say that because they like to dislike Jerry Krause. I think what people need to understand is Michael was there when he took over the job, but he put everybody else in place, including Jackson, including Tex Winter, including Johnny Bach.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Together the defensive schemes. That was all Jerry Krause. Now, he didn't handle himself very well at times, but unfortunately he's passed away, and we really can't get the answer to why did Jerry Krause make the statement that even if Phil Jackson goes 82-0, he's not coming back. I wish we could get the answer to that.
That's a great point.
Well, I know you had a hand in the three NBA championships with the Bulls, but you also had a big hand in the following three because the trade brought Dennis Rodman to Chicago when you headed to San Antonio.
It did, and, you know, at the time, that really bothered me because, you remember, Michael came back the previous year and played the last 20-some-odd games. We lose to Orlando in the semis, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And, you know what Michael's going to do when he comes back. You know what he's going to be like. He's going to be the Michael of old. He's now going to, as you saw in The Last Dance, he's going to reconstruct his body to be ready to play basketball. And I get traded the week prior to camp opening up because that was also a lockout that year. And then, but at the end of the day, you know, it really helped me learn a lot about myself. It helped me learn a lot about the game being traded. And it ended up being a win-win situation. I was fortunate enough to win another championship in '99 with the Spurs, but also, you know, to learn a lot from Greg Popovich. Meant a lot to me, but it also answered a lot of questions that may not have been answered if I would have stayed in Chicago.
Well, and Will, I'd be remiss if I didn't talk a little college basketball with you. I know you've done a lot of Westwood One. That's how we, connected and met a few years back in Nashville at the SEC tournament. I know you're a proud Vanderbilt alumni. You were SEC Player of the Year there. We all have seen the resurgence of SEC basketball, but I don't think it's truly going to be back until the Vanderbilt program can stabilize. Jerry Stackhouse has taken over there. I know you're very passionate about helping them. Your thoughts on Vanderbilt basketball and where it stands. And also, I've got to get your thoughts on your old coach, Sam Newton, who meant so much to three different places. I mean, he meant a lot to you and Vanderbilt, Kentucky as a player and athletic director, and then at the University of Alabama, really putting Alabama basketball on the map in the 1970s. It'll be 2 years already next week that he's passed away on June the 4th. But first, you know, what did Sam Newton mean to you? And then talk about the future of Vanderbilt basketball.
Yeah, so, you know, CM took a chance on me, quite honestly. You know, I had big numbers coming out of high school. He recruited me. He came to my house. My parents felt very comfortable with him. You know, because anybody that knows at that level, I mean, you're turning your child over to that coach. That coach is basically your second father. Some guys, it's the first father, maybe. But he truly was the definition of a gentleman, a Southern gentleman, but also, you know, a great coach. And I kind of got into some academic troubles my freshman year. I wasn't too focused on my studies. I kind of, you know, told myself I'm here to play basketball, kind of ignored my studies a little bit, kind of put myself at risk, put him at risk, put the program at risk. Yet he took a chance on me and stuck by me. And, you know, everything worked out. I can't thank him enough for that because of what happened, you know, in the future. But I think that time frame I was there because of him, a lot of us feel like was a turning point, you know, for Vanderbilt basketball, because behind him came Eddie Fogler and, you know, Stallings and some of the things that they've been able to accomplish. So we need to get back to that. The one thing I know about Jerry Stackhouse is he knows the game. He's really done a nice job of developing the guys that they've been able to get into the program. But as you guys know, and this is what makes college basketball so difficult to succeed, you know, on a regular basis. You know, Kentucky's figured it out. Duke's figured it out. But you have to be able to recruit, you know, and you can't go in waves. Mm-hmm. If you truly want to be successful, you have to be able to bring in guys that are ready to play right away every year. You know, you always see the Butlers and teams that, you know, all of a sudden they appear every 4 or 5 years because they take raw green freshmen and they develop them. And then when these guys are juniors and seniors, the teams are really good. But coaches now these days, they get fired for that.
Yeah.
You know, especially as the SEC, in my opinion, I think has turned it around. You look at the coaches that they have now, some of the guys that they've been able to bring in. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure on Jerry, regardless if it's Vanderbilt or not. Yeah, you're developing the guys you got. Now you've got to get some better talent and even develop that talent so that now you are a team. And at the end of the day, we all know who the benchmark is in the SEC, Kentucky. You got to get guys that can compete with Kentucky on a daily basis, and that's not easy.
It certainly
is
not.
No, it's not.
It is not at all. Well, Will, you've done a great job as a player now and in the media and as a broadcaster. I've enjoyed being around you at the SEC tournament and listening to some of your Westwood One calls as well. We really appreciate your time here in Huntsville, and we hope we can connect with you again down the road. But thank you for reminiscing on the last dance and your career and the great CM Newton. It's been an honor to speak with you, and continued to stay safe and continued success, man. We look forward to hopefully having you again.
I have a question.
Sure.
I have one question for you guys.
Okay, go ahead.
And we're kind of, you know, we'll be walking the edge here on acceptable material, but I won't use any foul language, but I do have a question.
Sure.
So, and this is how I found this out. So, my team going into my, I went to summer school in between my junior and senior, I went to summer school every year, but in between my junior and senior year, a girl transferred to Vanderbilt whose fiance was working for NASA in Huntsville.
Ah, okay.
We became really good friends. And we used to do that trip to Huntsville a lot in the summer, but also during the school year. But he would also come to Nashville periodically. We used to always joke, as you're driving to Huntsville, right after you cross the state line, there used to be that big billboard, Booby Bungalow.
That's right, in Elkton, Tennessee. Yes.
We used to, now, you got to remember, we're college kids. Then
yes.
We used to laugh our ass off and be like, what the hell is the Booby Bungalow? And I'm just curious, is it still there?
No, the owner, and I'm gonna really sound like I know what I'm talking about, but I do actually. The owner has since passed and it's gone away. It's actually now a storage facility. Yeah. So
I mean, if you want to talk about a name that befits the business.
Yeah.
It was a
perfect description.
Our producer Chad is bouncing off the walls right now. His grandparents live right behind it, so he was very familiar with it.
Yep.
So. You cannot mistakenly say, I don't know how I ended up here.
Exactly. Well, you certainly can.
We appreciate the time, and I tell you what, this conversation is making me miss Giordano's pizza.
Gentlemen, I appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Will. Really appreciate it.
Will Perdue with us on the Neighbors Wealth Management Hotline on this Thursday. We need to step aside. When we come back, we'll have more Talking Ball.
One of the best conversations we've had in a while.